Hello, friends. Welcome back. We're at episode 7 now. If you tuned into our Christopher Nolan episode last week, thank you very much. I appreciate all the listens. Means a lot. Love doing this podcast and talking about movies, so I really do appreciate it. So before we get into today's episode, some of you know the drill. We gotta go over our movie news for the week. So first off with movie news, I found this information out yesterday, so I had to include this in today's episode. They are adding, and they, I mean, the Academy Awards, are adding a new Oscar in 2028. It is going to be Best Stunt Design. I think this is well overdue. I think stunts and the stunt doubles are the unsung heroes of action films. They really deserve some recognition, so this is just a small part of recognition. But again, it's not going to start until 2028. So that's going to include all the movies from 2027 year. Watch Tom Cruise win majority of that because he does his own stunts. So next for movie news, we have a new film set to be released. It is set to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. This is by Ari Aster. I think he's great. I love Hereditary and Midsommar. He also did Beau is Afraid. Personally, I got lit up for this online, but I hated that movie, so I'm excited to see if this new movie is any good. It's called Eddington, again set to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, and the premise of the film is in May of 2020, at a standoff between a small town sheriff and mayor sparks a powder keg as neighbor is pitted against one another in Eddington, New Mexico. So this film is set to be a contemporary western, black comedy, and the cast seems to be stacked, so that's something to look forward to. We got Joaquin Phoenix. He was in Beau is Afraid, Pedro Pascal. I don't think Ari Aster's worked with Pedro Pascal before. Then we got Austin Butler. He's really making his way up in Hollywood. And then Emma Stone, absolutely love her, and many more. So excited to see how that goes. So that was our movie news for the week. I also saw Minecraft, and it was obviously garbage from a film standpoint, but the experience was a 5 out of 5 stars. Amazing, so much fun. I think Jason Momoa was hilarious. I had the best time, and that theater was packed out. So, obviously a good movie to get the box office rolling and get people back in the theaters, which we always like to see, you know? Now, time for my movie recommendation that is not on par with this week's theme. I didn't even get to this week's theme yet. I'm very excited for it, but the movie recommendation I have for you is Free Solo from 2018. This is a documentary about a professional rock climber, Alex Honnold, who attempts to conquer the first free solo climb of El Capitan's 900-meter vertical rock face at Yosemite National Park, California. This movie is amazing, has an amazing score. The cinematography is breathtaking. Definitely the type of film that makes you hold your breath as you watch him attempt to free solo this mountain. For those that aren't aware what free soloing is, you are rock climbing with no rope, no nothing, just your bare hands, shoes, some chalk to keep your grip. So you fall, you're done. So definitely not for me or anyone that cares about their life, but definitely a great movie. Okay, so for this week's theme, I'm very excited for it. We are talking about The Hunger Games. I absolutely love The Hunger Games. After I got over my fear of this movie, I was obsessed when I was younger. And we're not talking about all 4, or I guess 5, because they just made the prequel. We're not talking about every single film. I think it would be a good idea to really just take a deep dive into the first movie, and then as the podcast goes on, we'll eventually get to Catching Fire, Mockingjay Part 1 and 2, and then we can get to the prequel. I was also inspired to do a Hunger Games episode because we know that they had their Hunger Games Ballad of Songbird and Snakes prequel that came out in 2023, but we have the new Hunger Games film, I want to say, yeah, coming out next year, 2026, about the 50th Hunger Games. And for our fans, our Hunger Games stands, we know that that is about the second quarter Quell and Haymitch's Hunger Games, so I am super excited. And we just have to talk about it. These are great films. I think that they really influence pop culture. Still stands today. Massive fandoms. Amazing, amazing. So hopefully most of you listeners are well aware of what The Hunger Games is and have seen The Hunger Games. But just a little brief overview since we take deep dives here. The films are based off of the best-selling books by Suzanne Collins, with the first book coming out in 2008. I read in an article a while back that Suzanne Collins got the idea for the films, or books I should say, by flipping back and forth on TV between a cooking channel and then a film about war, and then the idea just came full circle and The Hunger Games was born. So Suzanne Collins wrote these best-selling smash hit books. 2012, the first Hunger Games film came out, and this is the film we're going to be discussing today. Just a brief overview of the plot. Again, most of you probably know what The Hunger Games is, so I'm really just keeping this brief. Set in a dystopian future, Katniss Everdeen volunteers as tribute for her sister's place in the deadly televised competition where teens fight to the death for entertainment of the ruling class, aka the Capitol. I was so beyond petrified of these films after I saw the first one. I did read the book. Not sure if I finished the first one when I was younger because my mom said we can't see the movie until you read the first book. Looking back, I got over my fear, obviously, and I would say I've seen the first Hunger Games, I want to say, maybe 30 times. I've probably watched the whole series. Yeah, so I guess like 30 times. Catching Fire is my favorite, but Hunger Games, the OG from 2012, is definitely a close second. And for our cast, I mean, I'm sure everyone knows our starring cast. We have Jennifer Lawrence, Josh Hutcherson, Liam Hemsworth, Woody Harrelson, Elizabeth Banks, Stanley Tucci. So much more as the films go on. And arguably, this film launched Jennifer Lawrence into stardom. I would say she just went from an actress to an A-list actress after Hunger Games came out. World fell in love. I think Jennifer Lawrence is awesome. I was probably petrified of her because, you know, she was Katniss back in the day, but so, so good. So rather breaking down the film from beginning to end, like I'm explaining the film, because most of us have seen The Hunger Games. I mean, it's been out for 13 years, the first film. We're going to have a deep conversation about it. We're going to start from beginning to end. We're not squeezing all 4/5 films into one episode. We're taking a deep dive into the first one. So one question I have for all of my listeners that we're going to touch on at the end is what happens when survival turns into spectacle? So we'll come back to that at the end. That's the vibe for this episode, because The Hunger Games in our dystopian future are a spectacle. It is media propagation. It is entertainment for people in the higher class in the capital. So I'll leave it with that so we can get into opening the world, just to set the stage for everyone and how the film builds its dystopian world before it really begins. So let's get into it. Now, from the beginning of the film, we're taken into a media interview with Caesar Flickerman. We'll get into him a little bit later. And Seneca Crane, who is the head game maker of The Hunger Games. So right from the beginning, Seneca Crane is saying how he thinks the games are something that unites all of us together, the capital and the districts. And then it cuts to Primrose Everdeen, Katniss's younger sister in District 12, screaming, crying, being so scared because this is her first year that she has to put her name in to enter for the Hunger Games. Okay, because how it works is from every boy and girl in each district, between the ages of 12 and 18, you are obligated by the Capitol to enter your name to be randomly selected, unless you volunteer, but we'll get into that, for the Hunger Games. So Prim just turned 12, so it's time for her to finally have a chance at getting in the games, which obviously no one wants. I mean, it's a competition to the death. District 12, a big thing about District 12 is that they suck in the games. They're probably the most poverty-stricken district out there, with the other outlying districts like District 12, District 11, District 10, all of that jazz. So Prim's scared. So in the beginning scene of the film, we're taken into District 12. This district is as run down as it gets. The set design with the houses, the costume design too. The first shot, and anytime the audience is just brought to District 12, there's just this muted gray tone through the editing and camera work to give the overall aura and the character of this place. It is just poverty-stricken at its finest. It looks like it's basically a town pulled out of 1800s. They got nothing going on. Their clothes are a flashback from, yeah, like I would say, 1800s. It's not modern at all, even though this is a dystopian, futuristic setting. So that just shows from the get-go the difference between the districts, or at least District 12 and the capital. Because the glance of the capital that we get in the beginning, too, the capital are those who are the higher-ups in this film, and there's a drastic contrast with the camera work in the capital rather than the districts, as they use vibrant colors, outrageous and over-the-top costumes, hair and makeup, and set design that is a big part of these films. It's dramatic, but that's the point. So from the get-go, the audience is faced with the capital versus the district, which in a deeper tone can also be seen as authoritarianism versus inequality. So there's definitely a deeper level to the Hunger Games rather than a preteen cultural icon for us in 2012, the early 2010s. It goes deeper. It really touches layers on political inequality and all that jazz. So that's why The Hunger Games is more than just, I guess, a teen film. And also, I just want to say right now, a little side note, Mom, sorry for cursing, but freshman year of high school, we had to pick out a book that we wanted to do a research paper on, and I picked out The Hunger Games, and my freshman English teacher, love her, but she was like, oh, that book's for kids, you can't do that. Literally, F off. I'm saying F off instead of fuck because I did like this teacher, because these books, while they are curated for children, they go deeper than meets the eye. So that was just my little side note. So back to opening the world of The Hunger Games before we really get into the vibe of the film and all the dramatics that take place. So The Hunger Games is set in Panem. This is a futuristic dystopian world built on the ruins of North America. We don't know any other nations besides Panem during this time period. And Panem is structured to reflect the extreme economic and class disparity between the districts and the capital. Little fun fact for my listeners in New York, I'm pretty sure based off of the map that some fans drafted up years ago, we're in District 12. So maybe I would be Katniss. Who knows? Who knows? And we're not giving that much background on how Panem became Panem, but some background we have is that 74 years before this plot line of Katniss Everdeen takes place, because this first film is the 74th annual Hunger Games, there was a war between the districts and the capital. Spoiler alert, the capital won, and as a punishment, the districts were gifted with the Hunger Games, sort of as a fear tactic to keep everyone in line to prevent future uprisings from, the district and capital again. Just if anyone missed that, as a punishment for the districts and entertainment for the capital, because it's essentially their biggest spectacle of the year. This is what they look forward to. One boy and one girl from the age of 12 to 18 will be randomly selected, unless you volunteer, from each district to fight to the death until a sole victor remains. And the sole victor will win riches for them and their family and never have to return to the games. Dun, dun, dun. Now that we've talked about the opening sequence and really setting up the basis for the districts, Panem, all of that, just so everyone gets the vibe, if you're not that much into the fandom like I fucking clearly am, now let's move on to the Reaping. The Reaping is also in the beginning of the film. This is probably one of the most iconic parts of the film. Everyone knows the infamous line, I volunteer's tribute. So the Reaping is where our districts all huddle around and one boy and one girl from each district are chosen to fight to the death in the games. Who was chosen from District 12, you may ask? Most of you know. But obviously, Primrose got fucked because her first year in the games where she was obligated to enter the Reaping, she gets picked. How unlucky is that? Luckily, Katniss's sister of the year. I'm an only child, so siblings, I would love to know if you can relate to Katniss, if you would volunteer for your younger sibling, but this whole scene sets the stage for Katniss being our protagonist, and again, her infamous line, I volunteer's tribute, baby. Primrose gets selected, and Katniss volunteers in her place, so Katniss becomes our District 12 female tribute. Unlucky. Now, just to backtrack just a little bit, even though this is kind of in the start of the film, from the start, we see that Katniss is very rigid. She's obviously been through a lot. I mean, the girl is fucking starving, clearly. She lives in the poorest district. Every year, two kids from her hometown get fucking killed in the Hunger Games, and it's a spectacle for everyone in the capital. So I absolutely don't blame her if she's going through a tough time, but She has no sort of hope for anything in her life, in her district. We only see that her softness is for her best friend Gail, aka Liam Hemsworth, and her younger sister Prim. Now for the male tribute, Peeta Mellark is selected. He is our male lead of this series. Him and Katniss are the same age, and as, I don't know if anyone remembers, you probably do, because honestly, how can you forget the first Hunger Games movie? As they go to shake hands, Katniss and Peeta, because that's what they have the tribute selected do, the film cuts to like a flashback of both of them. So it alludes to their history, kind of the fact that they know of one another, have met before. Katniss really isn't sure where at the moment, but we find out later that Peeta is very much aware of how he knows Katniss. But we'll get into that later in the episode and later in the series as well. And our last part of the reaping, a little thing that the Capitol does to be sincere and kind. Meanwhile, they're fucking making these kids go brawl out for a piece of bread. They let their loved ones say goodbye to the tribute. So as our loved ones are saying goodbye, first we have Prim and Katniss's mom go say bye to her. And then we have Gail, aka Liam Hemsworth, her best friend. He tells Katniss to find a bow and arrow. She has potential to win the games. And again, that also sets the stage for Katniss being our heroine, our protagonist, the boss ass bitch that she is. All right, now moving along in the film, the districts after the reaping are taken on, I guess it's like a bullet train dupe into the Capitol, where they train for a few weeks before the games begin. And on the train, we're introduced to Haymitch, played by Woody Harrelson. Personally, he is one of my favorite characters besides Katniss and honestly, Caesar Flickerman. In the 73 previous years of the games, District 12 only had one winner, and that winner was Haymitch. So now Haymitch is sent on every year during the Hunger Games, and he's a mentor for the tributes to kind of give them knowledge, advice, anything that may help them have a chance at winning and being the sole victor of the games. Another big part of Haymitch's character is that he's a drunk. And again, I do not blame this guy for pouring a drink at 8 a.m. because he had to get into the Hunger Games. He fought to the death. He won. What a horrible fucking life. So I don't blame him for pouring it up the first thing he does when he wakes up in the morning. Him and Katniss get off to a really rough start, but the beauty of them, they're just both very stubborn and rigid characters, both very strong-minded. They clash their personalities, but throughout the series, they grow this kind of unlikely friendship. I wouldn't even call it a friendship, even though at the end of the day, they do rely on one another. I love them. They're probably the best relationship of the series, I would say, at least in my opinion. So from the moment we're taken on to the bullet train dupe, I'm just trying to continue along. The colors in the camera are vibrant, excessive amount of food given to them, more food than Peeta and Katniss have probably ever seen in their life. Once again, just showing the complete imbalance between all the luxury and goods of the Capitol. They have all this food that they can just throw away. Meanwhile, Katniss is out hunting game to get a fucking loaf of bread. All right, now kind of moving on to the media part of the games. So we started with the opening sequence, the reaping, the train, and now we're getting to the media portion. This is the pre-games part. So we know that the games are meant for the tributes and it's propaganda to scare them to not uprise ever again against the Capitol. But what do the games mean for the Capitol and their population? The games mean everything to them. I mean, we see in the prequel that came out last year, this was set as the 10th Hunger Games. So 64 years before the OG Hunger Games and Katniss takes place. We see that they're not really that much into it. So what do? They make it a spectacle. So now going forward 64 years where Katniss is set, the games mean everything. It's a sick and twisted way. It's their most coveted event. They glamorize it. It's an obsession. And I think that's also a little deeper layer that the directors and Suzanne Collins did. The Capitol's obsession with fashion and the drama reflects the modern reality TV culture, I think. I mean, we watch The Bachelor, Bachelorette. Not that it's the same thing as killing people in The Hunger Games, but people love getting off on watching people cry and fight with one another on reality TV. So it kind of raises a question. Are we any better than the people of the Capitol. Saw that online and I thought that was really interesting, so I kind of wanted to include it in this episode. But anyway, as Katniss and PETA and the other tributes get to the district, we're kind of given this little montage sequence of them getting a makeover, washed up, everything, all glitz and glam before they're paraded out into a literal parade for the people of the Capitol to get their first look at this year's tributes. So the costumes in this parade that the tributes are given are meant to reflect each district, meaning, for example, District 12 is coal mining. I know that, like, District 3 is electricity. District 2, I'm pretty sure, might be luxury goods. District 4, I think, is fishing. So, like, each district represents something and they all provide goods to the Capitol, essentially. So the costumes, the tributes are given are meant to reflect each district, but in a dramatic way that makes a spectacle out of them. Like the tributes from District 4 are wearing like a giant fish just to kind of set the scene for anyone that might not be as aware as what I'm describing. So like I just said, District 12 represents coal mining. So this is where we're introduced to Cinna, aka Lenny Kravitz. This is no Lenny Kravitz hate. He's a cool dude, but acting-wise, Cinna is all he's good for, and I stand by that. So Cinna is a designer for the games and for the Capitol. You would think because he's a part of the Capitol, he's an asshole because he watches the games every year. He never has to go into them. But he's an unlikely ally, and he is a fan of Katniss's from the beginning. Cinna's a good guy. And he creates the costume for District 12 to represent coal mining. It's dramatic, but the regular people of the Capitol love it. Their black costumes representing coal has this kind of fake flame. I'm sure almost anyone has seen the scene. Firing the tributes up, kind of like from their back. And fire represents something deeper. This is another deeper layer of the Hunger Games, which is why it's so iconic. Fire is a reoccurring motif throughout the series. It just represents destruction, transformation, spectacle of all of it. President Snow, what's his name? Donald Sutherland. Oh, rest in peace, he died. Anyway, President Snow doesn't like it. Smart guy he is. He knows it's deeper than just fire. It means more. It could possibly mean rebellion. Cinna does that on purpose. I think that's why Katniss and him get along so well, because Katniss knows Cinna doesn't buy into all the bullshit that the rest of the people of the Capitol do. Now, another part of our media portion before we really get into the games, we have Caesar Flickerman, played by Stanley Tucci. I think while Caesar Flickerman himself as a character is not a good person, he is so entertaining. He's hysterical. If I couldn't be Katniss, this might sound bad, but I would love to be Caesar Flickerman. I mean, he's got his own little late night show and he gets to interview all the tributes and he's just a star. He's a star of the Capitol and that's that. And I don't care if it sounds bad, but I would be him if I couldn't be Katniss. So Caesar Flickerman is the Capitol's smiling mouthpiece of manipulation. He's a cross between a talk show host and a propagandist, because like we said, the games are really, at the end of the day, just all propaganda to keep the districts in line so they don't uprise again. So a big part of the media portion before the games really kick off, each tribute, so 24 tributes have their own individual interviews on, I think it's called the Caesar Flickerman Show or Late Night with Caesar Flickerman. Anyway, it's meant to reflect or represent like the garbage, like the Jimmy Kimmel Show. Because Jimmy Kimmel is garbage anyway. So each of the tributes are being interviewed, just like, what are their plans for the games, their life at home? Just dumb questions to ask these tributes as if they're not going to go brawl out to the death the next day. Katniss goes on before PETA. They go in district order. They're the last district. There's 12 districts. So it's Katniss and then PETA's last. So Katniss, the audience eats her up. And one big portion of that is because her dress that Cinna made for her interview will go on fire again, like at the parade. The whole crowd is cheering for it, so she spins around in a circle. Dress goes up in flames like it's meant to, and that's where she is coined the girl on fire. This also really represents a turning point as Katniss being our heroine, our protagonist, as fire represents, like we said, destruction, transformation, rebellion. They make a spectacle out of it to get the entertainment bump in for the audience, and President Snow despises of this once again. Okay, so now for PETA's interview, this is another big point of the film. because it is revealed that he has feelings for Katniss. So going back to what I said before, that flashback in the film kind of alluding to that they knew each other before, Peeta knew of Katniss very well because he has always had a thing for her. And we know this because Caesar Flickerman advises Peeta to win this thing so the special girl at home will go out with him. Peeta says that's unlikely because that girl from home is here with him. We obviously know that means Katniss. So Katniss does not like this information. She takes her arm, pushes it up against Peeta's throat when he goes backstage, does not like it, said it made her look weak, and Haymitch said it made her look desirable. So I think that kind of clicked in Katniss because this romance is a gigantic part of this series. Not only does our little love triangle come into place, because there is a big love triangle, we got Katniss, then we got Gale, and then we got Peeta all pining for Katniss. And again, big part of the film because Katniss is going to use this to her advantage later in the games, which we're going to get to in this episode. This might be a long episode, but I really don't care because I love the Hunger Games. Now, our final part of like the media and pre-games aspect that I want to touch on before we really get into the games itself. So the pre-games, the tributes are able to train ahead of time. I think they give them 2 weeks. And this is where tributes can interact with one another from other districts. Again, we have 24 tributes. And right from the get-go, the film really focuses on, I mean, we have a lot of extras, obviously, but the other tributes that this film and book cares about is the tributes from District 12 and the tributes from the career districts. And the career districts for our non-Hunger Games stands out there. It means District 1 and 2, they are the most lethal. Their tributes are mostly volunteers and they train their whole lives in the districts in preparation for going into the games. So we have Marvel and Glimmer from District 1, who are a big part of this film. And then we have Clove and Kato from District 2. Those are our career tributes. And the difference between these career tributes, District 1 and 2, the inner districts, from the outer districts is drastic. The career districts were on the side of the capital for the rebellion. They get certain luxuries most of the other districts don't. It's like an extension of the capital itself, essentially. The career tributes consider the games what they've waited for their whole lives and the highest honor they can have. I mean, they are sent to these. They don't really touch on it that much, but from what I've read from like fanfic, they're sent to these training camps to really... Yeah, they specialize in fighting and really a specific weapon. And by the time they're ready, they can volunteer if they want, because at that point, they're probably more prepared than any other district. And they win most of the games. We know that. They've touched on that throughout the film series quite often. Now, in training, we see the careers take an interest in District 12, mainly in Katniss, because they know she's a threat. Her fate of them basically wanting her dead is sealed after their individual training, meaning the tributes show off a certain skill set to the game makers, and then they give a rating on how skilled they are from 1 through 10. This is displayed on the media. Caesar Flickerman announces these scores, and it gives the people of the capital basically a chance to see how skilled they are, their chances of winning the games. One, to see if they want to sponsor them by sending them like medicine, food, water, anything they need during the games. But more often than not, to bet on these tributes for who's likely to win, like we're doing Super Bowl boxes, you know? The career tributes get, I'm pretty sure they either get 9 or a 10. But Katniss, first time ever, Katniss gets a score of 11 out of 10, higher than any other tribute. And like I said, that seals her fate. They want her dead. They know she's a threat. And I think they also just want to kill the girl on fire that the media loves, they're entertained by, to rip that hope away from District 12 too. All right, now for the big portion of the games, I want to say what we just talked about was, I want to say probably like the first hour of the film. And then games is the absolute rest part of the movie. So my favorite scene, honestly, this probably made me shake in my boots when I was younger. The tributes are sent into like separate areas before they're taken into the arena. They go up into these tubes. I feel like almost everyone knows the infamous tubes. And then as they go up through these tubes, they're taken into the arena, set on a platform. and all 24 districts are kind of in a circular formation. They got to be social distancing, like 6 feet away from one another, all surrounding the cornucopia that has supplies, weapons, food, anything. So the point of this opening sequence of the games is to all bring them into this cornucopia, and it is the bloodbath, they say. So Haymitch, his advice is for Katniss and Peeta to not even go to the cornucopia. Don't even worry about getting a weapon or anything. Just run. If you're gonna die, you're most likely to die in the first 5 minutes. So now Katniss is, because we follow Katniss in this part, we don't really follow Peeta. Katniss is sent up into the tube. It's kind of muted here in the film. It's like a ringing in the ear, and then we hear the countdown. We have the game makers counting down. I don't know what we start with, but it's like the worst New Year's Eve ever as they're counting down to one. Because then the games start, and then you're probably going to fucking die. But anyway, the anticipation of the countdown of all tributes in the circle around the cornucopia for the games to begin is absolutely haunting. The film goes silent. It's that muted ringing, like I just said. It's the score and the visuals of the bloodbath, and it still sticks with me today. This might be fucked up, but again, that might be one of my favorite parts of the film. Just directing-wise, I think it was awesome. Gary Ross, the director, used like a shaky camera as the cannon went off for the games to begin. And in multiple parts of these games, but especially in the beginning for the bloodbath, to represent Katniss's POV, which is disoriented, vulnerable, reactive. So we're not even really following Peeta, our male lead of the series at this point. We're really following Katniss. Now for a breakdown of what happens in the games, that we kind of just did the opening sequence of the games. I'm not trying to go fast, but most of you guys have seen this, so I kind of just want to describe the key parts of it. So a breakdown of what happens in the games. Obviously throughout the film, it's violent. I mean, we all know what it's about, but however, the film doesn't glamorize this violence. Like I said, the shaky camera and abrupt edits kind of create this discomfort in the audience rather than thrills. And I say thrills because in most action films, at least, the audience cheers for the kill with our protagonist slashing someone. But here, the audience is forced to sit with the weight of each death, just like the districts back home are watching, which I think is very genius and haunting as well. So again, I'm really just going to go over the big parts of the games before we get to like our final thoughts of this and the ending of the games. Now, a big part of this film, Katniss goes at it alone. She does get her supplies. She does not have her bow, though. A girl from District 1, aka our career district, Glimmer, has a bow, and there was only one bow, so Katniss really just has her backpack. And ready for this, everyone? Ready for our watchers? I got my action figure of Katniss and her bow right here. And her backpack going. She sits herself up in a tree, and as she's sitting there for the first night, after we hear the cannon sound representing each of the fallen tributes, we see the career districts form an alliance, so it's the four of them, and then a little plot twist, Peeta, their fifth member of this alliance, is with them. Now, Katniss at this moment, when she sees him, feels betrayed, but we know that Peeta is just doing that because the tributes of the career districts want Katniss dead. He's just allying with them to kind of throw them off, lead them in wrong directions for where she might be. Because one, he likes her, and two, he knows that she has a better chance of winning the games than he does. So he does this to protect her. Now, another big part of the games is when the career tributes finally find Katniss. How they found her is because Katniss was heading towards the force field. The game makers turned her around, sent her on purpose towards the district, so we get a little action shot, make it entertaining, make it reality TV for the audience. Fucked up as it is, that's the truth of it. So they're all running towards her, saying, "She's mine, I'm gonna kill her, I got her." Katniss climbs up a tree. They try and climb after her. Kato falls. The rest aren't as skilled of a climber as she is, so Peeta advises that they just wait her out. Now, while they're waiting her out, while they're sleeping, we see Rue, our 12-year-old icon from District 11, love her. She points to Katniss to saw off this, what is essentially a wasp nest. They're called tracker jackers, though. So Katniss saws it off, the nest falls down, breaks in the center of where all the career tributes and Peeta are sleeping. Dun, dun, dun. All the tributes get away except for Glimmer, who is the girl with the bow from District 1. So as she's legit stung to death by these Tracker Jackers, Katniss, disoriented because she got stung too by these Tracker Jackers, go back to Glimmer's corpse, claw off her hand off of the bow, gets the arrows, and there we go, got her bow and arrows. And that is also a big part because after that, Katniss and Rue kind of form this unlikely bond, and Katniss looks at Rue as if she were her younger sister Prim, which she knows she has a soft spot for. And that's a very big part of this movie. Rue is a 12-year-old girl. Unfortunately, she meets her end. Marvel from District 1 throws a spear. You see it pass Katniss. This is the worst part of the movie, honestly. Lands in Rue. Rue pulls it out. Katniss kills Marvel, and this is her first kill. She doesn't want to kill, and when she does, it's defensive and reluctant, so she did that as self-defense. This part's just incredibly sad. I mean, anyone with a heart. I don't really cry at movies, but I definitely tear up at this. Rue's death serves as an emotional anchor. It's a vital part of the series, not just in this film, but as a symbol throughout the other films. The funeral, like quote-unquote funeral, that Katniss does for her in the game. She lays flowers around her body, closes her eyes, and puts her hands in like the coffin position. Her funeral becomes a symbol of resistance and grief, not a victory. This is a big turning point of the series as the camera flashes back to those in District 11 fighting back against the peacekeepers, which are the soldiers for the Capitol. And honestly, this is our first little wave of the rebellion beginning. So Katniss is distraught when Rue dies. You see her sobbing, sobbing, sobbing. Seneca Crane, who's the head game maker, and Snow are pissed that Katniss kind of did this little funeral. She did a little three fingers up. Everyone knows that three fingers up for the Hunger Games. They know that she's a problem. They know that she's a symbol of hope, a symbol of rebellion for the districts, and they don't like it. They kind of want her dead, and Haymitch goes to plead with Seneca Crane not to kill her, not to make a martyr out of her, because that's what they would be doing if they just kill her, but instead give the audience of the Capitol something to root for. And what they do is give them something to root for. Haymitch says young love is the key to get the audience going. You might be wondering, what is young love? But if you've been listening, you know that PETA has feelings for Katniss, and this is where Katniss uses that to her advantage. So the game makers come on the speaker in the arena and say, the previous rule of just one victor remaining is now denounced, and two victors can remain if they are from the same district. So now what does Katniss do with this information? She snaps out of her little sighing and sobbing montage. I mean, it is sad, but she snaps out of it, and she's like, I gotta find PETA. PETA wasn't really in this part of the games as much after the little Tracker Jacker hive came down. He went running. He's no longer in that alliance that he was never really in because it was just for Katniss's protection. Goes and hides off. Katniss ends up finding him. So for the rest of the games, they're like, it is us too. We have to do this. We have to win. PETA's badly injured. Kato's sword. He got slashed. And his leg, like, that guy's gonna be amputated, it's looking like. Like, that's how bad this wound is. Now, a part of the game makers trying to make this more of a bloodbath, because now we're getting down to it with how many tributes are left. They say, every tribute from each district needs something desperately. It's gonna be in the center of the cornucopia. Try to lure them all in, maybe at the same time, to get what they need for it to be a bloodbath. PETA begs Katniss not to go. Katniss knows she needs to go because she needs PETA strong so they have a chance at winning. There's no way they're going to beat the career tributes if PETA doesn't heal. So PETA falls asleep. Katniss goes. This is where she has her another close encounter with death. The girl from the career tribute of District 2 almost kills her. Then we see Rue's male tribute kill Klo for us, shows Katniss mercy, which is another big part of this film that sticks with us for the rest of the series, lets Katniss go and says, just this one time, 12, for Rue. So Katniss gets the medicine, and then there we go, kind of getting to the end of the games now. So fast forwarding, end of the games. After PETA's healed with this special medicine that he needed for his leg, we have Katniss left, PETA left, Kato left. Thresh, who was Rue's male tribute from District 12, he dies. So now I'm really focusing on the last battle sequence of the games on top of the cornucopia. Luckily, Katniss and Peeta, they kill Kato. They throw him off. They let these game maker design mutts tear his body up limb from limb. Gruesome, but honestly, he fucking deserved it. He was the worst. Then the light shines up. The games are over. The two of them are left. They won. They were like, we did it. However, the game makers, being the asses that they are, they take back that rule and say, the original rule stands, only one victor can remain. So now they want them to fight it out. The two lovers from District 12 to fight it out. Peeta, the gentleman that he is, he puts his weapon down, tells Katniss to kill him, that she should go home to her family. This is probably the biggest part of this film and one of the biggest parts of the film series. Katniss takes poison berries, says her and Peeta should eat the berries to commit suicide, because if they can't both be victors, then the Capitol is not going to get a victor. So the decision to commit suicide by eating these poison berries with Peeta is a calculated move. By no means did Katniss ever intend to die out of love like Romeo and Juliet. It's just the only way to take control from the game makers. If they won't allow two victors, they won't have any, and Katniss stands on that. It's a refusal to give the Capitol the ending that it wants and be a statement that she'd rather die than be a pawn in their little game. So this moment specifically elevates the film from like a survival story to this political allegory. It's great. Ultimately, game makers are like, stop, don't eat the berries. The two of them win, thus setting the stage for the rest of the film series. And there you have it. That was our little breakdown. So we're not done yet. Don't stop streaming. But that was just our breakdown of the first film, first game. So some final takeaways. First off, with Katniss. Katniss isn't the typical chosen hero. She's thrown into this role she doesn't want. She wasn't even picked as tribute. She volunteered for her sister. Again, totally thrown into this role. And then after her win, she's made out to be this martyr and a savior, when really, she is just a survivor. Katniss becomes the kind of symbol for this rebellion happening later on in the films and the book series. This rebellion is quiet at first, choosing love, such as eating the berries, over violence, killing Peeta. And again, that's a big part that plays throughout this film with the different motifs, metaphors, and just symbols of love in general. Katniss challenges this system of the Capitol, not by attacking it directly, but by refusing to play into its emotional rules. Again, coming back to the berries, choosing to rather die than be a pawn in their little game. And another big symbol that Katniss ends up representing throughout this film series, especially in the first one, is dun-dun-dun. I'm showing her visual watchers. That's right, the Mockingjay pin. The pin is a symbol that grows with Katniss in the first film as protection, and then as identity, and then as revolution. And something fun that the film and book covers do too is showing first in the first film, like this Mockingjay kind of being huddled, bent over with an arrow in it, and then catching fire, bird exposing its wings, and then Mockingjay breaks away kind of from the circle that was holding it in. So that's kind of how the Mockingjay evolves. Some more final takeaways. Hunger Games, I fucking love these movies. I think it sparked massive adaptation and fandoms. I mean, the first movie came out 13 years ago. We got a prequel in 2023, and we're getting a prequel next year. That just goes to show, even a decade later, how much relevance these films still have today and how much of an effect it has on us audiences to make a movie, to drive people back into the theaters. It's amazing. I also think that these films dive into real-world discussions on inequality, media, and rebellion. I mean, we talked about it earlier on in the episodes, but still, there's just so many layers to The Hunger Games, more than meets the eye. So that's also why I feel like these films age well, if we're able to still kind of relate these deeper meanings to the real world today. Now, with a film series based on book adaptations, it's not going to be the same. I mean, there were definitely a lot of parts from the first movie that were different in the book. They didn't really obviously touch on as much as the book does. However, still great films nonetheless. All right, this episode was way longer than I ever intended it to be. We're almost at an hour. This is going to suck editing. But if you listen to the end, thank you for listening. This was just our first episode of the Hunger Games series that I want to get into. Not sure when I'm going to get into Catching Fire or Mockingjay, but it definitely will be down the line. So if you like this, definitely tune in for those episodes to come in the near future. Thanks for tuning in if you did. I love the Hunger Games, love talking about it. If I was talking fast, I'm just passionate about it. I mean, some of my passwords out there are relevant to the Hunger Games. I'm not going to say what it is so I don't get hacked, but I just love it. It's still relevant today, has an effect on me. I think that anyone who watches the Hunger Games for the first time can find something to take away out of it, something to love about it. It's amazing. I would say it's probably the best dystopian novel and film series out there. Screw Divergent and screw Maze Runner, because Hunger Games comes on top. And that is our closing statement. So thanks for listening. Come back next week for episode 8 of Uncapped and enjoy.